Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Weird Things podcast. I am Bryce Castillo, once again filling for Andrew Main, who is dead.
on assignment, we agreed.
In hell.
He's assigned to flogging himself for all eternity for hubris.
Posthumously, we can remember him as the for the first time being listed on the Wall Street Journal's bestseller list for Looking Glass.
That's right.
Wait, he's on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list?
I mean, leave
the
number.
Indeed on the Wall Street, number five on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list is Andrew Main for Looking Glass. So it's a shame he's not alive to see it, because I'm sure he would have really loved such an honor.
I'm sure he got the dead author bump, as we like to call it.
He's through the Looking Glass now, boys. Of course, joined with Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, hi, I'm That's Brian him. Brushwood.
And Justin Robert Young.
Hey, what's up, everybody?
Hey. I want to start off this week by showing you guys a photo. This was a phenomenon captured by satellite imagery. Put an image on the screen. Can you guys describe what we're looking at?
Oh, I might have to recuse myself, because my gut reaction was I looked up and I'm like, well, that's clearly a snowier picture of Mars than I remember, because you've got the burnt orange all over the place, and I assumed that was all carbon dioxide. But then the moment those words bubbled up in my gullet, I remembered that there was stories of mysterious orange snow somewhere on this planet.
So my first guess was a very, 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 very close-up look of a glass table in the back of a club in Miami.
Covered in orange snow.
Well, that's the club just, lights.
You know, maybe there's some red neon lights maybe above it that maybe makes that orange kind of look to it. But no. Other than that, I don't know. Yeah, snowy peaks, but it does have a bit of a red tint to
so
it.
I know that you have all the details on this, sure. Bryce. Maybe Justin and I can peripherally aware of the zeitgeist. I heard there's something about orange snow in Russia. Did you hear about this, Justin?
I have not heard about the orange snow in Russia.
Okay,
no.
Before we find out the actual answer, you want to speculate wildly about what causes the orange snow? Because it's a burnt orange. I'm going to say that all of Russia has become fans of the University of Texas Longhorns. Because I'll be damned if that's not exactly our team's color.
It does look like that pale orange.
It's amazing that we've been broadcasting together for close to 10 years, and for this is what it took to get school pride out of you. reference. I don't know. Yeah, but I don't know. It seems almost too bright for the burnt orange of the University of Texas. It almost looks like a sherbet.
So here's what I know. If you type in green iceberg, you'll see some images from, I want to say, Antarctica. And there's a particular type of algae that grows in them that causes this extraordinary green iceberg look. And it's really crazy, right? Mm-hmm. So I know that there's like red algae and green algae, and I know that there's algal blooms that happen on coasts or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know how – wait, hold on. We also know that precipitation often needs a nucleation point, whether it's rain or hail or snow, and that oftentimes it's bacteria serves as that nucleation point. So could it be that this is like an algal bloom or a fungus or a – Something that's at the heart of each of these snowflakes? Question mark.
I almost would wonder. Yeah, it's either that or maybe some, like, is it some kind of like, you know, iron or nickel kind of like a exhaust or explosion or something like that kind of mixes with the.
And it certainly looks like that, because isn't most of here's a good question on Mars. I thought the whole planet was made of rust. Is that right? Why is Mars red?
This is normally where Andrew pipes in and has an answer.
Well, I mean, thankfully, we have RoboAnts Andrew 5000.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to need to find a way to keep going now that Andrew's been confirmed is no longer with us.
He's on assignment in hell, working off a lifetime of penance.
Don't worry, he'll be back very soon.
Not even death can kill Andrew May.
The iron within the dust on Mars has reacted with oxygen, producing a red rust color, while the sky appears red as storms carry the dust into the atmosphere.
Man.
So spaceanswers.com.
I'll tell you what.
So yeah, that's what I would guess, because iron like has that sort of that when it oxidates, it has that look to it. So that would be my guess, is that would be the reason why we have the reddish hue here.
Okay,
either that or these Nickelodeon Kids Choice Awards have gone too far in their marketing.
So all right, so your guess is some kind of mineral that's been dusted up and gotten in with the snow. Mine is it's some kind of fungal, bacterial, or algal bloom. Similar to what we see in the seas, only from the skies.
Okay. I think Justin is probably the closest here. This is actually a phenomenon that happens every 5 years or so, where sand and dust from the Sahara are picked up via a storm and travel across the Mediterranean into parts of Eastern Europe.
Holy cow. That's crazy.
So that's a once every 5 year thing that a bunch of sand just flies up there?
Yeah, about every 5 years. This year was particularly noticeable. There's a lot of images out of Crete also, where the city is just caked in an orange haze.
Yeah, holy cow, look at it. It really does look like that's what terraformed Mars is going to look like. That's going to be Martian traffic jams in the future.
Well, I mean, Yeah, terraform. But if it's terraform, would it still have the iron blowing around?
Yeah, sure. Because I mean, the whole planet's covered in iron oxide, right? And so that's fines is what they call them, not dust. Dust.
We're not gonna take a Hoover to that real quick. Just just tidy it up before people show up.
Put it in one place.
Tidy it up. Just call in Molly Maids and just say, hey, listen, we got a big job.
Like, we're not gonna invite company over with dust all over the place.
Just need you to get it all cleaned up. I'll tell you what it reminds me of is around 15, 20 years ago. I guess, man, it must have been 20 plus years ago because I was still at University of Texas at Austin. Mm-hmm. There were wildfires in Mexico, not even in this country, in Mexico. And the clouds, the ash clouds, the dust clouds were enough to create a deep, deep haze obscuring the sun. Like you could, mm-hmm. It was always enough coverage that you felt like you could look at the sun at any time, although I don't recommend looking
don't
at the sun.
Do
yeah, don't
UV
do that.
Rays.
But it's like it was so covered, you felt like you could look at the sun.
So didn't that happen a couple years ago with the volcano that created like a gigantic smoke plume that was like affecting flights and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah, sorry, in Iceland.
Iceland,
yeah.
Right. The volcano erupted and affected air traffic all around the United Kingdom.
I mean, I guess really we're finding a million different ways to say like, air is rad and does cool things.
Well, and specifically, Earth be weird, man. Like it throwing its dust all over the place. It don't even care.
I mean, I guess that's part of it is just kind of realizing how much this is in Sochi too, where they had the Olympics not long ago. How awesome, how much better would the Olympics have been
if there was orange stuff.
Guarantee you the government would have put out a press release like, we like Olympics so much, everybody gold snow for everyone.
It's like comrade, it's orange.
It's bronze. It's like, a very bronze color.
It's gold if you want to survive. Who likes poison? You like poison?
Usually gold
it's
snow.
It's gold.
Gold snow is usually something to be avoided.
Don't go to England. You might get some bronze in your food.
Jesus.
It's a really dark reboot of Yakov Smirnoff.
Yeah. In Russia, we murder you. In post-Soviet Russia,
we'll kill you and your daughter.
Oh, jeez.
Okay, so
making it real. Way to go, Justin.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
It's my favorite cheap shot.
Oh, man. Well, if you want to support cheap shots like that every single week, you can support us at patreon.com/weirdthings. You help make sure that this show happens every week, even when Andrew Maiden has died and gone to the pits of hell.
Yeah.
He will be back soon.
You know what? Normally when Andrew dies, we do things like go to his funeral, arrange for his estate. Not anymore. No. Now when he dies, thanks to your sweet $450, give or take, we show up every single week. And we want more reasons to keep showing up and animating that. You ever see Weekend at Bernie's? That's what we do here on the Weird Things podcast.
Yeah. Animate his corpse. I like to think that Andrew's down there like going through like the seven trials of Beelzebub. And he's only on two.
Well, and the reason he's only on two is because he keeps criticizing them for the setups. He's like, really? This is lazy writing, guys.
You know, if you tie me up in the rope like this, I'm just going to get out very easily. Watch.
I mean, do you call this a logic puzzle? Like, it really doesn't. Like, if I were to redo it, and I'm not giving you notes here, but if I were, I would.
Let me tell you about the Monty Hall problem.
I would say that I figured it out on my own, but the true answer is I eat Lucky Charm cereal, all right? So I already know all of these.
I saw it in the back of the box.
Lucky Charm cereal has the cheat code for Beelzebub 7 trials.
I mean, look, man, they've fallen on hard times.
It's a panic move. They're like, listen, like, dude, have you seen the new figures? We are in the red here at Lucky Charms.
No more R&D. It's like between the atheism movement and all of these non-believers coming in, we can't afford for a high quality puzzles.
So put the puzzles of Beelzebub on the back of the.
There is one thing. No, Steve, really? Yes. I think it's time we finally reveal the answers to the seven trials of Beelzebub.
So what's funny is I was thinking the reverse. Like they were constantly writing new trials, but they ran out of bandwidth, and so they were just copying them from Lucky Charms.
But I like
the idea that the General Mills Corporation paid them handsomely for the answers.
To get the answers, and that you could just pay anybody.
It's like, you don't need salvation. Just memorize these answers for when you get to the trials.
Yeah. Live the way you want. Pure freedom for every Lucky Charms consumer.
All tiny text.
No, this.
Tiny text upside down that says the goat head, the bronze chalice.
Seven.
I escaped from hell by memorizing these seven crazy cheats.
And I got box tops.
For education.
Gentlemen.
Well, thank you, Andrew Maiden, wherever you are.
And thank you to all of our patrons who make sure that Andrew can go to hell. Patreon.com/weirdthings. We love you, Andrew. Gentlemen. Do you guys know a gentleman by the name of Mike Hughes?
Mike Hughes.
Mike Hughes.
Man.
Yo, yes. He's great.
I did a play once and I had to follow all of him. My cues.
Oh, no.
I'd never
ever wish more that you had a trap door that I could just press up.
Just chunk.
Right into trial number one.
The goat head.
Guys, can you throw down a box of Lucky Charms, please? I didn't get a chance to read.
So,
Mike Hughes, who's old? Who's old Mr. Hughes? What's Mr. Hughes up to these days?
Sure. Well, you might know Mike Hughes. In 2002, he set a Guinness World Record for a limousine jump. He's built rockets for years.
Wait a minute. Is this the dude who's trying to prove that the Earth is flat by riding a rocket up high enough to say, oh, nope, we're wrong?
It is that gentleman. He over this past week, launched a rocket of his own design that he manned and tried to go up high enough to confirm his theory that the Earth is shaped like a Frisbee.
Okay. I think we've talked about this on the show. I'm convinced that this dude is just a stunt daredevil kind of guy, and he realizes that, you know, some people get sponsored by Pennzoil, and then all of a sudden, overnight, they decide Pennzoil's the best oil. It's great. Some people get sponsored by General Mills, and they're like, feeding your kids sugar and flour is very healthy. In this case, I really think this guy just wants to, he just wants to fly his rockets. And he's like, what? They'll give money to, yeah. Hey, the world's a frisbee. Ain't no round world. Let's find out.
So you think he's in the pocket of Teach big flat debate. Earth.
Teach the debate. I mean, so, I think he's playing the flat earthers. I think this guy knows.
You think that he is playing them for money? I would go the other way, and maybe, you know, when all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail. I would almost say that this is, instead of him taking money from flat earthers, this is him giving a hook to literally every press outlet that is going to cover the guy who's like, if you're right and he's a daredevil, right? Then he's risking his life, like, is his trade, right? That's what he does, is crazy stuff that might kill him, but he survives. But giving it a nice little coat of paint, so now all of a sudden it's not local daredevil tries to shoot himself out of a rocket. It's flat earther, idiot flat earther does idiot move. Like, let's all point and laugh at the big fat idiot. And that's going to get a lot more eyeballs.
Why not both? Seems like it's a win-win all around. You get the flat earthers to fund it, and you get the press to show it. And then at the end of the day, this is one of those insane heel moves that's so far out there, he can undo it with one statement. Like, yeah, I went up, I saw it, the earth is round, it's definitive. And he can feel like Copernicus for stating the obvious, meanwhile spending the money and earning the attention of all the planet.
So I don't necessarily know that he is very moneyed at this point. On Saturday he took off in a homemade rocket over the Mojave Desert. He went up about 1,875 feet. We have a very small clip
launch. Aren't there buildings that are higher?
Taller than 18 stories?
I mean, that looks like a really good theme park ride.
Oh, it does not show him come down safely. It just shows him go up and then just hover in the air, and we're done.
How safely did he come down?
He landed and did have undescribed injuries, but was giving quotes to the Washington Post. So he's not dead. They also got this great photo of him being put into an ambulance. So
number
one, dude, safe to say... Brian, would you describe him as an old timer?
No, I would say that Bernie Sanders has looked better. Yeah, that's
this is Bernie Sanders, Doc Brown.
Bernie Sanders flying back to Earth. You're like, I went so high, I saw the 1%,
the top 1% of the bottom 5% of the atmosphere can prove that it's a frisbee.
I tried to grab as much money as I could before I came back down.
Oh gosh.
Did he parachute back down? Does the article indicate that?
It does not. I'm going to see if I can find...
Because otherwise, I'm going to decide that he got up there, he climbed out, and then straddled that rocket and rode it down like Slim Pickens at the end of Dr. Strangelove.
Let's see. I'm
with you. Okay. I like that one.
So we've got the SpaceX and analog of their live stream.
It's just a semi.
All right, so he goes up.
So he goes up.
We're now live narrating this video.
He sort of holds, and he comes down. Oh, so he does have a parachute. Out.
Okay, but oh my God! How terrifying
must
that be?
Tumbling. It's not even going straight down.
Oh my God! Yeah. So yeah, that parachute had a hell of a time getting level. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's gonna have. Looks like he's about to have a rough landing. I'll tell you what.
And here he comes.
This is basically one of those soda rockets. He just
oh my
shot
God, wait,
Sprite
so
everywhere.
His rocket has the parachute. He does not have the parachute. So that thing's coming down like a ton of bricks.
Right, and he's in it.
Yeah.
So he is in this rocket as it makes its way down. Oh my God, this is horrifying.
It is just swinging around all akimbo.
A second parachute.
Late.
Kind of late. Yeah, very too late to slow it down. Maybe a
Yeah, it doesn't look catastrophic, but it definitely comes down nose first and just ka-clangs on there. I mean, I bet he got banged around a bit.
A severe car wreck would probably be like the basement that you would describe something like that, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're not talking orange snow or nothing, but pretty pretty heavy duty.
So he seems
okay.
He's doing fine. He had a helmet. He's good.
He had a helmet. Adam Savage live on the scene, helping him out of the.
He's just got like foam padding in there, like stuff that you would find in a box with your couch.
Like the way I would pack my props for the magic show,
like an egg drop project.
Oh my God! All right, wait, hold on. So, how high is 1,800 feet?
1,800 feet is 1/3 of a mile. I want to say it's not even as tall as that building in Dubai.
Yeah.
That's what they love you to call it, by the way. They're like, Mission Impossible featuring that building in Dubai.
By the way, I flew here right before we started from Florida. The plane that I was on was at 39,000 feet.
Yeah.
he flew close to 2,000 feet. So theoretically, if he wanted to get up super high so we could confirm whether or not the Earth was round or flat,
should have just gotten on a commercial flight. Yeah.
Yes. He would have done.
He would have been. He would have been
better job.
He would have been 15 times more successful had he just spent $99 on a fun fare on Southwest.
The Burj Khalifa in Dubai tops out at 2,717 feet. So he was short by almost 1,000 feet. Of beating the world's tallest building.
Wait a minute. Hold on. You said that building was how high?
2,717 feet.
Wait, but he only went 1,800 feet.
Yeah, he was 1,000 feet short of that.
Oh, short of it. Got it. So he didn't even make it.
He would have probably made it to right about there.
So he took an elevator in the wrong place.
Well, it came back down.
He also could have just gone to Dubai, flown commercial to go to Dubai, yes. At which point he would have been 15 times higher, then landed and be like, now my expedition begins. Press up
and go to the landing deck.
Man, that's how you get the money from those flat earthers. That's what you do.
Expeditions to Dubai to the tallest building.
Well, yeah, because at least there you'd be in a luxury hotel.
That's where they should do the launch.
Instead of
the conspiracy element of this, because sure. Brian, you're like, how much do we know the bona fides of this man's love for flat Earth?
He had, as I remember, never ever shown any interest in claiming the Earth was flat until a year and change ago, when suddenly he was like, I've decided the Earth is flat. Also, I'm raising money for an expedition called Let Me Build My Rocket, suckers.
So you think he is a... Well, I mean, the name on the video was like Mad Mike Hughes, insinuating that he is a stuntman or daredevil kind of guy.
Right, he is.
Or very angry, just constantly pissed off.
So I'm with you, Brian. I think that was the you know, listen.
So
go ahead.
I will say that if he is trying to bilk the flat Earth community out of its goal, I don't know that it is that he's doing a very good job. In 2016, this is from Wikipedia.org, Hughes launched a failed fundraising attempt for a rocket that earned only $310. Another campaign that he launched.
That seems crazy. I feel like if we would have known this, we could have doubled it.
Yeah. You have more coins in this room than he's earned from flat earthers.
You're actually, hold on.
I'm actually right.
No, you're not kidding.
You're there. Just a bunch of dollar coins.
Although, I'm looking at more dollar coins than he earned.
Across two campaigns. So it's like I think maybe part of him wants that money, but I don't know that the flat Earth community is throwing around a lot of money to get this stuff figured out.
I do think, though, that it's like you want to have a sponsor. You want to have a team that you're playing for. And I think he figured out after years and years of being just a lone nut, nobody loves the lone nut story. Okay, so if not the money from the flat earthers, then definitely what Justin said, like, that is an in to get front page on something every time you do anything, is to throw the words flat earth on there. Like, there's no way this guy believes that the earth is flat.
Well, to be honest, it's like, we're in a very, very weird time right now in our media consumption, because when everything is provable, you can always find a thing to counter what, like, your belief is. So, you know, we're seeing this a lot now in politics, where it's like, oh, can you believe the other side is doing blank? And then you can find one person somewhere on Twitter or Facebook or something, and now elevate that person to be an animated caricature of your counterargument, right? Mm-hmm. And this, I think, is just him understanding that and stepping into the limelight and saying, look at me, I'm crazy Mr. Flat Earth, I'm gonna build a rocket and I'll prove all you roundies wrong. And now the big rush is not from people on his side, because he can't even fund his rocket. Like, it's not flat earthers being like, yeah, finally the science we've wanted. It's people who think the earth is round, obviously, saying, look at the crazy old kook doing a kook dance in the desert. I wonder if he'll die. Come see our CNN report.
Yeah. This is also from the WashingtonPost.com. Also among his plans, aside from trying to get to space, is to run for governor. Quote, this is...
following in the footsteps of Gary Coleman and Mr. T.
This is no joke, he told the AP. Quote, I want to do it. So... there you go. Future Governor Mike Hughes.
From where? Where is he running for governor?
He's in California.
Nice. So. Good. Yeah, big race coming up. I think Hughes is really interesting candidate. I mean, look, he can look at Gavin Newsom right in the eye and say, did you fly 1,800 feet in a rocket of your own creation and then crash down startlingly to Earth?
No, but I have been in a commercial airplane.
Yeah. You know, like, oh, la-di-da. Look at this, Mr. 1%.
Do you think that is the argument there that we're not really going 39,000 feet from a flat earther?
I believe their story is this is a disc, and if you look out the window, it seems
it doesn't look round or curved enough.
right unless you're using like a GoPro camera with the wide angle lens that bends everything
so
down.
That's how Elon Musk is faking all that stuff. I mean,
actually that's part of the justification as I understand it.
Yeah. So that's that. I got another story here for you guys.
Yeah.
You guys have been pretty on top of the stories today. So I want to just tell you what this is about and see if you can tell me a little more about it. It's a little headier stuff. Do you guys know what time crystals are?
Time crystals? Why, yes. If I'm not mistaken, Justin, we first encountered time crystals in the Matrix of Destiny, our most difficult mystery to date.
Indeed, we found the map on the back of Life cereal because they wanted to counteract the huge success of Lucky Charms.
Which was weird because both belonged to General Mills, and I pointed this out at the time, but you seemed unconcerned.
One of the greatest internal rivalries of breakfast history, Life versus Lucky Charms. It was like harnessing of the mystic and occult.
It was BuzzFeed Red versus BuzzFeed Blue all over again.
Time crystals. I remember we found the time crystals only to be scared of their tremendous power.
Yes, because they were so... what's the word I'm looking for?
Timely. They were very punctual. Whenever you asked them to be somewhere, they were there, probably even ahead of time.
Oh, hold on. I wonder if you've stumbled into something, because when I hear time crystals, I want to imagine it's some kind of like, you know, Kalaxian crystals that go forward or backward in time or whatever.
Sure. Crash Bandicoot, I believe, collects time crystals.
I wonder if maybe there's some kind of periodicity to them, like they grow at a reliable rate. I'm making all this up. This is pure speculation. But
oh, good. Oh,
but
okay.
But I would imagine if time crystals were always growing at a constant rate, that would be a very valuable dating device. Kind of like, you know, layers in ice.
Or like cores. Rings on trees.
Yes, or rings on trees, that kind of thing. Am I anywhere close?
I think you were conceptually close.
Okay.
Justin, do you have an idea what time crystals might be?
No, I'm going to piggyback on Brian's because that was really smart, far smarter than some dumb joke I was going to make about myself.
Time crystals are crystals.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
They're crystallized herbs, specifically time.
Stop it.
No?
No. Where's the trap door button?
Yeah, you crunch them.
It needs to be a big lever because
you put them on
a roasted
rotisserie chicken, and they're just delicious. Okay, time crystals.
So I'm going to use gizmodo.com.au's description of time crystals because it's very succinct. Despite their name, time crystals are relatively easy to understand. Their atoms have an innate property called spin, which turns each one into the smallest possible bar magnets. Time crystals are systems of atoms which, with a regularly pulsing force, such as an electric field, acting on them. This force causes the spins to swap directions regularly, except the spins ticking does not need to align with the field's pulsing. So,
wait, so this is like a pendulum. It's tick-tock, 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 only it's something you could measure after the fact.
Right. Basically, there's a little bit of a graphic here, but basically the atoms are in such a way that when you provide a force onto them, that they will, at a set interval or a deterministic interval, will switch polarities back and forth.
Right.
This is spin versus regular, where the magnetic fields don't
This sounds, to my dumb journeyman brain, it sounds a little bit like how atomic clocks work, right? Okay.
The atomic clocks are more about half-lives.
Okay. If predictable amounts of time on that.
Right. So this is back in the news again because DARPA has funded a program called DRINKS, Driven and Non-Equilibrium Quantum Systems, in a classified manner. Quote, the applications could be used for atomic clocks where you have an ensemble of atoms you're vibrating to extract time information. There might be applications related to measuring things with exquisite sensitivity in time and magnetic field domains. Not a lot of these applications are open for discussion.
You know, exquisite is one of my favorite words in the English language.
Yeah.
It's woefully underused. And so that what an exquisite example of it.
Exquisite use of exquisite sensitivity.
So what it makes me think of is, I think we've talked about this on the show before, but the evidence, the hard evidence that we have for how often the poles switch polarity in the magnetic thing. The magnetic thing, that's what scientists call it.
Earth's magnetic field.
Earth's magnetic shield.
Field.
I like shield so much better.
We're knocking it out, baby. 100%.
If I remember correctly, there are clays that have ferrous components in them, and humanity has been making clay pots. And the moment the pots are fired, whatever global polarity is pulling the ferrous parts for it, align everything in one direction. And then like in roughly 10,000 year increments, we could see it pivoting back and forth. It sounds to me like this is somewhat similar in concept.
So, yeah, to give an explanation of a real world time crystal that was created, one of two real world time crystals was shot with a laser at a regular interval, and they found that when that time crystal was affected by that that laser's force, the time crystal this is really tough to describe because it's atomic.
It would become angry and threaten people.
It would switch polarities at half the rate that it was being pulsed by this laser. Like it was at a regular speed relative to the force, the laser's force. So if you had a time crystal that was reactive to, say, magnetism or some other force that you were trying to measure, you could measure the crystal's reaction as a way to measure this other field.
So is this a new discovery or a new use for this we've figured out?
The new thing is that it's being funded right now. So the time crystals that we know about
the flat Earth research. that's two funding.
DARPA's really heavy in flat Earth research.
You never know, man. What a game changer it'd be.
So time crystals. It's very heady. I read about 10 articles trying to understand this as easily as I could, and I think the fact that we don't have an immediate understandable use case outside of like atomic clocks
just as a testament to the esoterica that it represents.
Yeah.
But it does seem like the more the more clocks or clock-like natural occurrences that we have, the better we're able to date everything. Basically, we could go on dates thanks to these sweet gems, is what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, I think that not only for historical dating, but also like, you know, the importance of time and keeping time, and that is like really one of the low key most important parts of like all civilization and order, and like historically, if you look at who really controls. Well, the world, it's who controls the time, like who controls like all that.
So I'm going to mangle this story, but I want to say, and as recently as like what, the 1700s, 1600s, 1800s. In fact, I bet you can find this, Bryce. Okay. There was a contest because you can look at the sun and get an idea of exactly what parallel you're at, your latitude, mm-hmm. north or south, but your longitude, there's no way to know how far east or west you are unless you have precise time. And so precursor to the X Prize and a precursor to the Fly Across the Atlantic Prize, the question was, can somebody develop a chronometer that's so precise that you could rely on it? And many ships would, when they eventually had them, would go out with like three or four of them to keep them, because one of them might get a little bit off. But if you knew for a fact what time it was back in Spain, you could figure out how far close to the new world you were. Hmm. So in that regard, like that's no joke. Yeah. Like the ability to know the time is one of the most fundamental important. In fact, knowing the time is why we're able to pull GPS stuff.
Right, GPS uses time. And imagine if all the GPS system functioned on another magnitude of accuracy with time, that would
allow for increased precision.
Right.
Oh, that's interesting. So if time crystals were used in the satellites to give ultra precise readings,
and they use time crystals,
we'd be able to figure stuff out.
Military technology.
Yeah.
They would have even more precise location data.
JC Calhoun in the chat asks, why didn't they just use your cell phones, bro?
Oh, they
I don't
do
get
that.
It.
They should just do that. Yeah.
Just ask Siri. Siri, which way is America? All right. Also, America is a big landmass that we haven't yet discovered.
Siri, who are these Indians?
Alexa, order toilet paper.
Stop it.
sorry.
Jesus.
Don't worry, we'll just get Postmates. That'll calm them down.
Okay, we have one last story. This will probably be a little shorter. Do you guys know Schultz's Star?
I don't.
Oh, that's based on the famed Peanuts cartoon.
Yes, it's the saddest star because he's not as bright as the star that led the wise men, and so he's just moping around the neighborhood.
Yeah, although he's friends with both Snoopy and the Red Baron.
Oh, you never see those two in the same
But the
place.
Red Baron is a red giant.
So about 70,000 years ago, Schultz's star is believed to have visited the outer reaches of our solar system.
Like our solar system had a near miss with another star.
Let's just say
there was a flirtation and nothing got out of hand. It was just a couple words exchange. It was in the very outer reaches.
It was a one-time grinder experience.
So
dude, we're still heliocentric. It's not any weird thing.
Helio exclusive, please. So Schultz's star is a dim red.
You're saying there was a brief moment where we were helio curious?
Yeah. Well, maybe. Schultz's star is a dim red dwarf star.
Hey, hey. He was cute. And we had a wonderful brief tryst as he flew by. We don't need to make judgments on his intelligence.
Not fine. Come on.
So we believe.
I mean, let's just say we didn't pull him into our orbit for his intelligence. All right.
So we believe Schultz's star came within 0.8 light years of our sun. That's 50,000 plus AUs.
Oh, and what a light year it was.
By comparison,
oh, what a light year.
In comparison, MU69, a Kuiper Belt object that New Horizon will reach in 2019, is only 43 astronomical units away from the sun. So, very
43 very AUs is nowhere near
37,000.
Yeah.
But we believe that Schultz's star.
Right, fine. It was an online thing. But the point is, there was a real connection. We felt each other's pull.
Schultz's star, this is to quote this Gizmodo.com article, grazed the outer reaches of the Oort cloud.
Hold on, say it slower.
Grazed.
Oh, God, did it. Reaches.
Oh, yeah. It just Oort caressed the fringes of that Oort cloud.
It has been eons since old Mr. Center of the center of the solar system grazed an Oort cloud like that.
Oh, but don't we hear about it every Thursday night at poker? Did I ever tell you about Schultz's star? Only every time we see you, Sol. Saul.
Saul.
We're going to call him Saul.
Better call Saul.
Better call Saul.
Saul, good star. So new research published this week in monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Study suggests that Schultz's star affected the trajectory of Oort cloud objects, that it got close enough to actually bring objects in the Oort cloud out into its.
That's cool. What people don't realize, what it means to get close to a celestial object. Everything moves. You feel ripples years to come, light years to come.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there you go. Now, there is this is very controversial. There are a couple of critics.
You're damn right it's controversial. Everyone thought we were just a lone spinster spinning around. No, yeah. We're vibrant and alive. 13 billion years, or no, that's 5 billion years. Is that how long the sun's been around? 5 billion years?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
5 billion years looks so good, you will not.
So
that's a line I wrote that nobody's ever written anything similar to.
That's because I wrote it 5 billion years ago. Suck an egg, George.
So a physicist and mathematician, Wesley Frazier, said, that he believes that the data is biased in this research, that they selectively picked objects from the Oort cloud and are not he's not quite sold yet that Schultz's star got close enough to affect the Oort cloud.
Yeah, you know what? Let me refer you to another doctor, Dr. Kinsey, that says there ain't nothing weird about a star grazing my Oort cloud, all right?
Sure. But this is
you're damn right.
I love the fact that we're like hayseeds in favor of gender equality.
Yeah. Well, geez, I mean, don't put it right there, Brian. We're just talking about space. I won magic time. That was Schultz's star. Oh, of all the Oort clouds in all the galaxy. And why did that not be Schultz?
In any case, one last note is they believe that even though Schultz's star is about 50 times fainter than what you could see with the naked eye at night, it is possible it could have briefly flared up and become visible as illustrated
for one magical
this image
night.
For they said
oh, wow.
Up
so
to hours.
It would be visible from Earth and it would just be a big red dot. Like a big like the unit like the solar system had hit record.
It's the tally light for Earth.
And they're all hanging out at the campfire like God's recording us again. Oh damn it!
Exactly. No, all the primitive civilizations are like scribbling on walls, and we've later translated it to say, smash that subscribe button.
And so even though this is admittedly probably not anywhere close to affect Earth at all, in the least, that illustration probably did not ever happen because of how faintly and how briefly the star could have possibly been visible. But the idea that this is the closest star that we know about and could have affected the solar system is kind of a big deal. It's a deal. It's a medium deal.
I mean, certainly any, I wonder how fast it was passing us by, because it's far from the closest star now, right? Like, closest is what, Proxima Centauri, or?
It is now 20 light years away.
Yeah, man.
So, wow. Geez. I mean, isn't that always the way? These stars rolling in, grazing your Oort cloud, and then you never hear from them again. What a tale of heartbreak.
Yeah. I don't know. But imagine, I wonder if there is, to sort of synergize on the show a little bit, if there were some way time crystals could be used to measure far out.
You can't measure love, exposure. Bryce. You can't. This is why you'll always fail. You and your kind.
Yeah. Movie.
Oh man, you want to science away what happened here? It was special. It was magical.
I don't care how long or how much he flared up. He was ours.
Look at this Oort cloud. My Oort cloud still ain't settled down. It's like a petticoat spinning all around.
It's a Schultz star. I was trying to think of a song. I couldn't think of a song.
No, I think you got the opening lyrics to
Schultz star. Where are thy?
Yes, I remember that. And then it shows the Schultz star like working out in a gym, and then it said,
yeah. "Are you flaring up with my Oort cloud ends?"
Yeah,
and you are the best. I swear this will never end.
Okay, and it's like he's pumping iron, and then the camera zooms past him, and you see a Neil deGrasse Tyson and Carl Sagan shaking their heads with jealousy.
Yeah, exactly. And then the rest of it is a Neil deGrasse Tyson monologue about how this is very statistically improbable, and we should probably just move on.
But we talked last week about Stephen Hawking's upcoming co-authored paper about
posthumous paper
and posthumous
his peepee. His posthumous paper. What?
Fast forward.
We talked that Stephen Hawking, among other researchers, may have a way to measure if there are parallel universes.
PU. All
right. It's a good show.
No, sorry. Keep going.
Picks.
I'm just saying, I wonder if there is an intersection between all of these things, between time crystals, which could be incredibly sensitive at measuring things, and parallel universes, which would require measuring
unprecedented levels of fidelity of
measurement. Yeah,
I'll tell you what it makes me think of is one of the most interesting space telescopes ideas that I've heard is imagine along the orbit of Earth. I assume Lagrange point. I guess. Uh-huh. Imagine an array of space telescopes spanning the entire orbit of the Earth, and then all of a sudden you essentially have a lens that size that can see with unprecedented fidelity by comparing notes between all the different ones. Yeah, I don't know. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, interesting. Hopefully we'll find out more about just what's going on in space.
All right, Justin, I got a question for you. It's about your pick. Have you picked
a peck of pickled peppers?
Justin, I'm not going to say.
Have I read the book that you told me to read last week? No, I have not read the book that
you told
me.
Okay, because you know who did?
Who?
Bonnie's Brian read Brusher. The whole thing. She
really?
Consumed it in 3.5 days. It was unbelievable.
Conspiracy
by Ryan Holiday.
Is this your pick for this week?
No, it's me admonishing Justin on my
good. Brain.
There you go. Stuff it, Justin.
Definitely the audience gets what they have always wanted, admonishing me for my slow reading.
No, what my pick is the new Steven Pinker book. I just started it, Enlightenment Now, and I'm enjoying it very, very much. It begins with the same I know that Andrew has expressed concerns about the way he kind of poo-poos the concern over artificial intelligence. I've not yet gotten to that chapter, but I do love what a refreshing change of pace it is, just like reading Better Angels of Our Nature, to read Steven Pinker that just says, look, we don't get to decide by our feelings or our vibes or what it seems like is going on around us. We have one way to judge the world around us, and that's by numbers. And we have numbers, and by every possible metric, things are better than they've ever been before, demonstrably, unquestionably, and anything saying anything otherwise is unscientific. It's so punk rock. This punk rock positivity, I really, really dig, and I'm looking forward to listening to the book, even if some now deceased members of our panel disagree with his work.
You don't need to drag him in death.
I'm not even convinced he's going to stay dead. Seems to me like he's going to have Satan working for him in no time and be back here.
By the way, we just got an alert. He's now cleared the third trial of Beelzebub. So.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
Sending those box tops for Andrew, guys. Just by General Mills.
Eat a bowl of Lucky Charms and tag at Andrew Main and just say that you're thinking about him. I'm sure he's still getting – I'm sure hell has Wi-Fi.
Do you have a pick, Justin?
Yeah, I got a pick. So there's a I'm for no reason, I'm obsessed with the election of 1960 lately. And the book that I finished a couple weeks ago was, I think, really good. It's The Real Making of the President, Kennedy, Nixon, and the 1960 Election. It is a bit of an answer to one of the classic campaign books, The Making of the President, which was written by one of the people that was like in 1960. This is more of an academic look many, many, many years later, knowing what we know now about so many of the actors. But 1960 is a fascinating election that includes Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, obviously, but also, you know, LBJ was a huge factor for Kennedy. And it was at the dawning of a technological era. In fact, the first convention to ever use videotape, like the brand new invention of videotape, was the 1960 Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, which took, really made it a showcase television event and not like a CNBC live stream of a very perfunctory, boring thing that happened. It was much more of what we know it now as a coronation. And there's a lot of great stuff in there. It is a fairly unflinching kind of academic look at it with a lot of facts and figures if you're a political nerd, but go ahead and check that out.
Very cool. I have a pick. I listen to a lot of music, I like to think. And over this past weekend, Spotify got a new discography on it from an artist that I didn't ever expect would get on streaming media. It's a Japanese rock band called Sakan Action. They started off as a five-piece rock band, but then over time and as they've gotten more popularity, there's been a very noticeable intentional shift in their music from like rock to rock and electronic sounds, electronica.
They're doing time crystals, aren't they? Their timing's getting better. They're more precise. They're showing up on time.
And they have a really fantastic sound, and it's been a long time since they've even put out new music. Their last studio album was 5 years ago. And it's incredible, which is the album that I'm recommending, their self-titled album, Second Action. I think I'm going to put in a little bit of music under. And it's really cool to like just listen. It's a really fantastic album because it's a mixture of what they call internal and external songs. These, you know, external songs, which are like very mainstream and are for a general audience and have been used in commercials and TV shows and stuff. But then these internal songs that are more electronic, less rock, very meditative almost. Like the very first full-length track on the album is a 5.5-minute instrumental electronica song. And this is from a band that did like this really cool rock song for NHK's soccer coverage. Like it's a band that has like a lot of breath. And that's really cool. And there's a confidence in this album of like, okay, we're gonna start off real deep, and we're gonna come back up and be very mainstream, and we're gonna keep going deeper and deeper and deeper as you go between, you know, radio hits and these really just cool, funky, minimal songs. I don't know. Their record company is there's not always a streaming music in Japan is not the same landscape as it is here in America.
It's, yeah, by which it's, you mean not finally dominated by Spotify,
right?
The soul crushing monopoly.
And I mean, basically, and you know,
wow, that was a quick transition, by the way, that we went from like, can Spotify survive, to like, oh, thanks, Exxon, go pound sick.
But like they wouldn't even have, when they put their music videos on YouTube, they would geolock it only to Japan. So if you were outside, you couldn't even watch or listen to it at all. You'd have to buy it if
you
it was available.
You have to swear allegiance to the emperor.
It was real tough. So when seeing that all of their stuff is now, or almost everything of their stuff is on Spotify now, it's really exciting because they're just a really cool band with a really cool sound. And it's been a very long time since they put out music. The album that I mentioned called Second Action came out in 2013, and since then they've had, count them, 2 songs since then.
Wow.
It's been a while, but the way that they write and the music that they write is fantastic. So I recommend that.
Is it heavy on lyrics? It's all in Japanese, or is it more
it is
instrumental?
It does have a very heavy lyrical element to it.
To enjoy that fully, do you go and look up the translations, or do you just read the vibes?
Because I've listened to a lot of Japanese music, I have an approach where I will try to just listen for it aesthetically and listen and enjoy it phonetically. But going and looking up the translations for this album in particular, they're really great. You know, a lot of the songs about youth and loneliness and love and all sorts of themes, is an extra layer of enjoyment that you can get out of this. And even the Wikipedia, I even say, go to the Wikipedia. They've gotten a lot of really good information from like interviews with the front man of the band who also writes the lyrics, and they talk about like, oh, you know, they recorded this in his house, and you know, the band wanted to do this, and they were fighting about this and that, and you go and find that they wrote all of the music for this album before he wrote any lyrics,
which is
a kind of weird, crazy idea.
Sure. Well, and that's although not without precedent. I know that the Beastie Boys albums, Paul's Boutique, was almost entirely already produced by the Dust Brothers, and basically they just came in and they're like, this is great, we'll just make up raps to go over this, and then they did.
And like conflicts with the band of like, well, hey, we're moving into an electronic style. Do we really want our big promotional singles to be these big rock numbers, these very kind of more mainstream rock, and straddling that line and straddling that in keeping with the theme of the album, which is a Mobius strip, in that it's kind of both sides as one side. I think it's really cool. We'll have a link in the show notes for it because it's on Spotify now, and I think I never expected that, so that was a very fun surprise this weekend. Gentlemen, thank you guys for coming on and doing the weird things again.
Heck yeah. Thank you to the patrons for holding our feet to the fire and burning us alive so that we have blisters on our feet.
That's right.
Thank you to United Airways for getting me home so I could do it. And hey, you want to thank you to Andrew Main, who is, currently traversing Beelzebub's 7 trials in hell, and hopefully will one day return to the show if victorious, and if not, spend an eternity in Old Scratch's sulfury domain.
That's right. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.